You're just in time for the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff, the radio outreach of the Christian Research Institute. Our purpose here at CRI is to equip Christians to pursue sound doctrine, to discern truth and error, and to become faithful disciples of Christ, because life and truth matter. This is a live program, and we invite your calls. So dial toll-free 888-ASK-HANK. Numerically, that's 888-275-4265. Now, here's the president of the Christian Research Institute, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. I was talking to our eTruth subscribers earlier in the day. I did a video which is going to arrive at the inboxes of those who subscribe to eTruth. And by the way, if you haven't subscribed, all you have to do is go to equip.org, and it's /eTruth to subscribe. It's free of charge. But I was talking about an article that I read in the paper just this morning titled, "Cosmos's Reboot Offers Fond Return to the Vastness of Space," an article written by Hank Stuver. And in this article, with sarcasm dripping from his pen, he talks about how the new cosmos arrives just when we seem to need it most. Hardly a day goes by where the news feed doesn't produce some freshly galling, he says, example of intellectual backsliding, with age-old fights resuming over science textbooks and religious instructions on education and governing. And then he talks about the host of the show, the new host, DeGrasse Tyson, who tells viewers in what he calls a carefully but beautifully phrased invitation to have an open mind. And I couldn't help but think of how ironic that was, in that Cosmos has never had an open mind. Under Carl Sagan, people were told to believe the universe is all there is and ever will be. In other words, no room whatsoever for the supernatural. So Christians are the ones who have an open mind because we allow for both natural as well as supernatural explanations for what we encounter in the universe. And I think of Carl Sagan, who was a fond promoter of recapitulation, the idea that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, that the emerging embryo goes through all of the evolutionary phases. So at one time it's a creature, and later on it becomes a child. And this becomes necessary as a legal framework in his mind for things like Roe v. Wade, because if you abort early, you're not aborting a child, but rather aborting a creature. All that on doctored drawings, which are still part of some textbooks today. The author, Hank Stuver, goes on and says, in the new cosmos, we have Tyson telling us about the Milky Way spiral, where our sun becomes just one of so very many. Now, the Earth is situated between two arms of a flattened spiral galaxy, but this is not something that is an accident. If we were closer to the core, not only would we be subject to lethal, violent radiation, but in fact, we wouldn't even be able to observe as we can observe the universe at this point. We couldn't have a cosmos, in other words, in terms of a show. He goes on to say that beyond even that, Tyson's hypothesis is that our universe might just be a teeny, tiny bubble, one of many universes in a multiverse, which, of course, is an utterly desperate attempt to account for an unfathomably fine-tuned universe. And as Stephen Hawking colleague Roger Penrose put it, the hypothesis is both impotent and misconceived. In many ways, what it does is it throws common sense under the bus. He ends his article by saying fans of Sagan's show might find the first episode remedial. Then again, given the tenor and muck of public discourse these days, maybe it wouldn't hurt to start from scratch and explain to everyone how the Earth is round and revolves around the sun. Of course, the Bible doesn't teach flat Earth mythology. This is a mythology concocted by people who wanted to discredit the Bible. If we look at history, we know that the great theologians from Augustine to Aquinas pronounced the Earth spherical. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that a lunar eclipse is not created in the context of a flat Earth. So here you have a guy that is sarcastic about how we've fallen back in science and demonstrates the reality that he doesn't do science well and certainly doesn't know how to read literature well either. I've written about all of this and much more in the Creation Answer book, in which I tackle all of these and many more issues. And the Creation Answer book is available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. A lot of you hanging on. We'll go right to the phone callers. First up is Jim. He's listening in Pennsylvania. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Hank. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
Good. Hank, I got a question. I got you a book, The Apocalypse Code, and it is, I'm just reading it all day. And the question I got is the New Jerusalem, in particular, the dimensions of it. My understanding is that it's going to be a cube 1,500 miles wide and 1,500 miles in width and a gold transparent floor. Now, you got on page 126 104 cubic thick walls. I don't need that. I need the answer. What I wanted to get the answer is, you know, confirming the fact that it's a 1,500-mile wall.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I point out in the Apocalypse Code, this is not about how the New Jerusalem looks. It's not what it looks like. Rather, it has to do with what it is like. So the language that is being used should never be read in a hyper-literalistic fashion. The same thing is true when you get to the first chapter of Revelation. You have a description of Jesus, but very obviously as you read the description, it can't be what Jesus Christ looks like. It says something about what Jesus Christ is like. Also what Jesus Christ is called, a lion and a lamb. The same principle applies. It has nothing to do whatsoever with what Jesus looks like. So what's going on here with the holy city? The luminous beauty is repugnant when associated with the extreme wickedness of the harlot city, which is glittering with gold and precious stones and pearls, but it's resplendent when it's associated with the extravagant wisdom and the wealth of the holy city coming down out of heaven from God. So the harlot city is an obvious parody of the holy city. And that is the same when we talk about the description of heaven as a cube. Its measurement is not only parodied by the length and width of Mystery Babylon, the ancient Roman Empire, but as with the cube shape of the Holy of Holies in which Jehovah dwelled, Jerusalem, when it's imagined as a cube, will forever be the dwelling place of God. And that, of course, is precisely what John says. Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. So I think, as I point out in my book, Afterlife, what you need to know about heaven, the hereafter, and near-death experiences, this is a matter of learning to read the Bible for all it's worth, rather than reading it in a wooden, literalistic sense out of which nothing but nonsense can emerge. I want to go back to the phone lines, talk to Paul. He's listening in Roseburg, Oregon, NRB Television. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Hank, I was just wondering if there is any place in Scripture that explains the purpose of human existence.
Yeah, I mean, the purpose of human existence throughout the Scripture is to worship God and love Him forever. I mean, this is the reason that Jesus Christ came, so that the fall could find its resolution in a restoration. So Paradise Lost, where God walked with Adam and Eve in the cool of the day, would become paradise restored, where God once again would be with us. We would be His people. He would be our God. He would wipe every tear from our eyes. There'll be no more death, mourning, crying, or pain. So in the fall, the Imago Dei is tarred. It's tarnished. In the forever, it will be restored, and then we will be able to do what we were created to do, and that is have fellowship with God and love Him forever. And this not only applies to God, but it also applies to fellow creations of God. It applies to other human beings. Indeed, it implies the entire universe restored to what it would have been before sin entered the world.
Well, it just seems like God already has eternity with Himself, and He has a perfect loving relationship between Him and Self, and not Him, you know, like the Holy Trinity and everything. And it just doesn't make sense to me that He would create us just to love Him.
Well, I don't think you want to minimize the function of love. I mean, you're absolutely right in what you said in the prologue to your statement right now. It's true that God is self-existent and He is self-satisfied in the relationships that He has within the Godhead. So there's one God revealed in three persons who are eternally distinct, and they love one another, and they're satisfied completely in that love. So I think you're right in saying that God didn't need to do this because love was non-existent, but the fact of the matter is God did this because He desired fellowship with humanity, in fact, desired it so much that He was willing to suffer more than any man, more than the cumulative sufferings of all of humankind, so that we might be restored to Him for time and for eternity. That's the message of the Bible. Can we fathom God's purposes? Can we fathom why God would love such a one as I? I certainly can't fathom that, but the Bible clearly teaches that very thing.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, you pretty much answered as closely as I can conceive it. Yeah, thank you.
You got it. Thank you so much. And again, this is, I suppose in some way, you could legitimately say a mystery. Why does God desire a relationship with me? But yet He does. And not only that, but He makes me a participant in the process of redeeming the universe. We are caretakers of the garden He's placed us in. And as such, we are not only part of fulfilling a great commission, but we're also part of fulfilling a cultural mandate. I want to go back to the phone lines, and we'll talk to Teresa in Topeka, Kansas. She's listening on Bot Radio. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Hank. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
Good. Thank you for taking my question. I really enjoyed listening to your program.
Thank you.
And my question is this. Is there any place in the Bible that it tells us when the angels were created, or have they always been there with God from the very beginning of time?
No. You know, the angels came into being at a particular point in time. We don't know exactly what that point in time was, but we know through inference, through theological deduction, that it had to be before the creation of Adam and Eve. But God has existed for all eternity. He's eternal. Angels and human beings are not eternal, nor is the universe eternal. The universe came into existence at a specific point in time a long, long time ago. But God is eternal. All the things that God has created were created at a point in time. And again, we don't know exactly when that time was, but we do know from theological deduction that it preceded the time of Adam and Eve.
Right, and that is really what I meant when I said time. I didn't mean right with God, but I knew it was, I figured it was sometime before Adam and Eve is what I thought.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, thanks, Hank.
Hey, you got it. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. Uh-huh. We are going to break. And as we go to break, I want to read you a quick letter that says, Hank, I've wanted to make a donation since February. When I first heard on the radio that the Christian Research Institute was behind on donations for the year, I was taking action. So he wanted to make a donation since he first found out that CRI was behind on donations for the year. And he said, I'm taking action now because of your book, The Ostinification of American Christianity. I did hear you read a man's letter where he is no longer supporting your ministry. And then he goes on to say that he now is going to support our ministry because we've taken on a very, very significant issue. I'll talk more about that on the other side of the break. We'll be back in just a few moments with more answers to your questions right here on the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
Theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss, the director of Arizona State University's Origins Project, will stop at nothing to find a naturalistic explanation for the origin of the universe at the time of the Big Bang. This includes defining the nothing from which the universe emerged as something physical and assigning to it several attributes traditionally reserved for God. Take a look at The New Nothingness in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. To start your subscription to the journal, call 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org. Stay with us. Hank Hanegraaff will be back with more after this. From the outside, Houston preacher Joel Osteen is charming, attractive, and his teaching, well, it makes you feel good. But the truth is, Osteen preaches a seductive and highly dangerous form of Christianity that's leading millions of people astray. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a new book called The Ostinification of American Christianity. And it's why you must get your own copy today. You must be able to defend yourself with truth about what Joel Osteen really teaches. And this important resource arms you with everything you need to do so. Please call today and request your copy of The Ostinification of American Christianity, 888-7000-CRI. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Sandy Hook School, the Washington Navy Yard, the Aurora Theater. Mass murders such as these have been shaking the national composure with alarming regularity. And such shootings only begin to tell the story of gun-related violence in America. Should current gun laws be strengthened, or does the solution lie elsewhere? Other topics include The New Nothingness, a look at Lawrence Krauss's A Universe from Nothing. God is love, but is love God? Does the Bible require Christians to attend church? God and the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org. The battle for authentic Christianity has never been more intense. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a new book called The Ostinification of American Christianity. As the title suggests, Ostinification is nothing short of the wholesale transformation of American, indeed global, Christianity. It is the prime provocateur of a seductive brand of Christianity that reduces God to a means to our ends and beckons multitudes to the table of the Master, not for the love of the Master, but for what is on the table. You need to defend yourself and those you love against these insidious teachings. Please call today to request The Ostinification of American Christianity. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.
Hank Hanegraaff has written a new book you need to get your hands on. Called The Osteenification of American Christianity, this important resource shines the light on one of the biggest threats to the church in America and around the world. And it shows how you can defend yourself against its lies that can leave you spiritually naked and vulnerable. The Osteenification of American Christianity is our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. So go online to our secure website at equip.org. That's equip.org. Let's return to your host, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you much, Randy. I was kind of butchering a letter that I got from Mark just before the break. In essence, what he was saying is that he wanted to make a donation to our ministry, particularly after he heard about my book, The Osteenification of American Christianity. He says, I wholeheartedly believe that this is one of the most dangerous attacks on God's truth ever. And I did hear you read a man's letter to you on the air where he's no longer supporting the ministry. You are doing God's work, and I'm currently struggling with living only for God, and I look to you as a part of my growth to living for God alone. Thank you for your work, and thank you for being a good example of how I need to not care so much for this world, but for the truth and for walking in the will of God. The safest place to be is in God's will, and not where conditions are most favorable. And I particularly appreciated this letter because if I'm completely transparent with you, my audience, I have to tell you, when I take on subjects like this, recognizing that every time I do, I'm creating a smaller island for our ministry, certainly from a financial standpoint. So I have to ask myself in each and every case, if it's a calling, do I do it regardless of the consequences? In other words, you have to come to grips with the fact that being faithful doesn't always mean winning. That's the reality. I mean, if you look at the disciples of Jesus Christ, they were faithful and fruitful. But Paul was shipwrecked, he was stoned, he was left for dead. And he ultimately said, whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss. Why? Because the greatest value was an eternal value. And these are things that I struggle with because I knew, for example, when I wrote the Apocalypse Code, that there would be a price to pay. I still remember being at a church with a very close friend of mine who was the pastor. I had spoken at that church, and afterwards he was driving me back to the hotel, and he told me if I published that book, our friendship was over, plain and simple, and he would no longer have anything to do with our ministry. These are the kinds of things that you face, but I had spent over 15 years studying this subject before I said anything about it on the radio. And I felt compelled to write the book knowing that there would be a cost. The same thing was true when I wrote Christianity in Crisis, Counterfeit Revival. In fact, it was even true when I wrote the Millennium Bug Debugged. I had major Christian leaders basically cut me off, one saying that I was going to have the blood of millions of people on my hands because I was causing complacency within the body of Christ. So at the end of the day, you have to make a decision whether this is a popularity contest or whether this is a calling. And if it is a calling, you can't figure out whether this is going to be good for business or not. You have to do it because it's a calling. And then trust God. At the end of the day, trust God. And so I'm greatly encouraged by letters like this. I got another one today that says, I have been listening to the Bible Answer Man broadcast for over a year now on Sirius 131, all the while saying, I need to support this ministry financially and yet have not. A few days ago, I was listening to your broadcast and heard you read an email from a supporter that claimed that they were going to discontinue supporting your ministry because of your revealing the truth in your book, The Ostinification of American Christianity. Goes on to say, and I won't read the whole letter, but it was very encouraging. He says, I thereby knew it was time to support your ministry and have finally done so. So replace at least one of the pillars that could not withstand the weight of truth with another pillar. I'm now a monthly supporter and plan to buy many of your books and provide a financial shot in the arm time to time. I'm with you, Hank, your team, your ministry. God bless you all. These letters are not insignificant to me because, quite frankly, I needed the encouragement, and I'm very grateful for that encouragement. I wrote the book because I felt it was a calling, The Ostinification of American Christianity. It is available right now for your gift to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute. And for those who join the monthly Bible Answer Man support team, I'd be pleased to personalize it to you, a family member, or a friend. I can also personalize one of my other books to you, a family member, or a friend, as my way of saying thank you for joining the support team or making the transition from making a donation to become a partner in a ministry that stands for life and truth, no matter what the cost. And this is no trifling issue. I've said it before, but behind Ostinian self-affirmations like I am prosperous, I'm anointed, my God is a supersizing God, there lies a darker hue. Behind the smile is a robust emphasis on that which is negative. If you're healthy and prosperous, words created your reality. But if, God forbid, a baby dies or a spouse contracts a terminal disease, you are oftentimes the prime suspect now feeling guilty that your words created your reality, because Osteen makes it very clear it's a spiritual principle and it always works. Words create reality. But the biggest problem, and this is noted with example after example in the book, is that with virtually every page of an Osteen book, and this is true whether you're talking about Osteen or Joseph Prince or a host of others, with virtually every turn, you'll hear them say, Scripture says, but if you take the time to actually read the biblical text, you find that Scripture says nothing whatsoever of the sort. Again, The Ostinification of American Christianity, available for your support. I wrote it just for our constituency. It is a book that is available not only in a paper form, but it's also available on CD audio. So you can get the CDs as well. I have just voiced them myself, and they're going to be up on the web shortly. Let's go back to the phone lines. We will talk next to Paul. He's listening in Pleasant View, Tennessee on Bot Radio. Hi, Paul. Paul, are you there?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I think the name is wrong. It's Sammy.
Hi, Sammy.
Hey, how you doing, Hank?
Good.
I first wanted to just tell you that I'm completely with you on the book that you just wrote. I have not read it, but just from what I've been hearing you say online on the broadcast, I'm 100% behind you on that. It needed to be written.
Thank you.
I've been listening for a while, and you and I agree on pretty much everything. A few things we don't agree on, but that's okay. but one of the things was, and this may not even be anything we disagree on, I just need clarification, is I take a literal interpretation of Scripture, okay? Now, not all the time, because I obviously know that there's allegories and metaphors and symbols and things like that, particularly in Revelation, but more for the people listening, not so much for myself, I'd like you to kind of expound on where you draw the line on allegories, because you can't allegorize the entire whole of Scripture. So do you understand what I'm saying?
And I agree. I mean, I take the Bible literally as well, but what does that mean? I think what you're suggesting is that it means that you take the Bible in the sense in which it's intended. In other words, you read the Bible as literature. And so if you come even to a historical narrative in which Jesus Christ is called a lamb, you don't suppose that Jesus Christ has four legs. You take that in the sense in which it is intended. Or if Jesus Christ is described as a door, you don't think that he has wooden hinges. So taking the Bible in the sense in which it's intended, or reading it as literature first, I think, involves taking careful consideration of what genre you are reading. For example, the book of Revelation is an apocalypse, but it's not just an apocalypse in the sense of an unveiling, but it's an apocalypse in the sense of a linguistic matrix that has its root primarily in the Old Testament. In some cases, when you're reading Revelation, you're reading a virtual rewrite of Ezekiel. But what's interesting is John doesn't take the illustrations or the language and reproduce it in an identical fashion. He tailor-makes it for his purposes. In other words, he shifts the metaphors a bit. But this is language that is very much language that we have to see in the sense in which it is intended. Some of the imagery that is used obviously cannot be taken in a wooden literalistic fashion, unless you think Jesus has a tongue that looks like a sword. You have to read it in the sense in which it is intended. And the sense in which it's intended is not obscuring meaning, but rather it is highlighting meaning that we would otherwise miss. So I think it's really important to understand the art and science of biblical interpretation. This is one of the great disciplines in the Christian faith. When we talk about the art and science of biblical interpretation, we say it's a science in that rules apply. We say it is an art in that the more we apply the rules, the better we get at it. Now, let me give you an example of this. I was listening to an episode of Bill Maher's show, the notorious comedian. And he had a guy on named Bill Nye, the science guy. And they were both yucking it up at the expense of the Bible, because they saw that in the very first pages of the Bible, it was disqualified as being, well, being true. And the reason was because they saw in the Bible that God put two great lights in the sky. And as Bill Nye, the science guy, pointed out, God didn't put two great lights in the sky. Even if there was a God, he could have only put one great light in the sky. That was the sun, because the moon is not a light. It only reflects light. So what he was doing there was demonstrating that he was a fundamentalist from the left that didn't know how to read literature in the sense in which it was intended. And of course, when you read the Bible in a wooden literalistic fashion like that, all you come up with is, in the end, nonsense. And this is precisely what happens with skeptics. They come up with nonsense, but not because the Bible is full of nonsense. It's because they can't figure out the difference between heat and light. We'll be right back in just a moment.
Houston preacher Joel Osteen is the de facto high priest of a new brand of Christianity perfectly suited for a feel-good generation. He's the prime provocateur of a seductive brand of Christianity that is nothing more than a cultish movement. Hank Hanegraaff has written a book that combats Osteen's false teachings with truth, and he wants to send you a copy to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. So please call to request your copy of The Osteenification of American Christianity, 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI. We'll be back in just a moment with more from Hank Hanegraaff.
The battle for authentic Christianity has never been more intense. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a new book called The Osteenification of American Christianity. As the title suggests, Osteenification is nothing short of the wholesale transformation of American, indeed global, Christianity. It is the prime provocateur of a seductive brand of Christianity that reduces God to a means to our ends and beckons multitudes to the table of the Master, not for the love of the Master, but for what is on the table. You need to defend yourself and those you love against these insidious teachings. Please call today to request The Osteenification of American Christianity. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. In the new book titled The Myth of Persecution, Notre Dame scholar Candida Moss argues that the tradition of long, bloody persecutions of Christians by a hostile Roman Empire and the heroic martyrdoms of the faithful have been invented by the church and its historians. There is only one problem with this thesis: the actual historical evidence. Other topics include the gun control debate, two Christian perspectives. Alexander Solzhenitsyn confronts the Grand Inquisitor, what cops can teach Christians about the critical use of language, don't all religions lead to heaven, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org. From the outside, Houston preacher Joel Osteen is charming, attractive, and his teaching, well, it makes you feel good. But the truth is, Osteen preaches a seductive and highly dangerous form of Christianity that's leading millions of people astray. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a new book called The Osteenification of American Christianity. And it's why you must get your own copy today. You must be able to defend yourself with truth about what Joel Osteen really teaches. And this important resource arms you with everything you need to do so. Please call today and request your copy of The Osteenification of American Christianity, 888-7000-CRI. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Christianity is under attack, but the enemy isn't who you think it is. The enemy is a new kind of so-called Christianity that exchanges the glory of the cross for the glory of consumerism. Hank Hanegraaff exposes this false religion in his new book, The Osteenification of American Christianity, and he wants to send you a copy to thank you for your donation to support this Bible Answer Man broadcast. So request yours when you go online to equip.org with your gift today. That's equip.org. Let's hear more from your host, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. And I want to remind everybody that the coining of the word osteenification is not singularly pointed at Joel Osteen, although it is derived from his name. And the reason I used him as the prime exemplar is because of his size and the scope of his ministry. I think about the fact that he has 1 billion impressions on Facebook and Twitter combined per month. These are his statistics. So it's a pretty large empire. And so osteenification can be seen in many different churches and is part and parcel of the ministries of many men that you see on your television screens, or you hear about, who are very, very prominent. So the basic idea is that this is a new or fresh face of baptized humanistic psychology. It's a new Babel reaching to the heavens, all the while promising your best life now. And Joel Osteen is the de facto high priest of this new brand of Christianity, perfectly suited for a feel-good generation. Again, the book, The Osteenification of American Christianity, available for your gift all this month. You can check it out on the World Wide Web at equip.org or write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Resource Consultants is always standing by, 888-7000. And the letter C. All right, back to the phone lines. We'll talk next to Richard. He's listening in Georgia on the web. Hi, Richard.
Oh, Hank, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you. Hey, I have a question about Daniel, the succession of nations that you wrote about in your book, As God Spoken. And when I'm trying to explain that, I meet some resistance, you know, because people are so used to the model where, you know, Rome is included as either the fourth part of the statue in Daniel 2 or the fourth beast in Romans 7. And usually they have three main objections that I just need your input on. One is when the second beast of Daniel 7 is talked about, it talks about one side being up, you know, higher than the other, which they say is, you know, the Persians and the Medes. The two arms on the statue indicate Persian and Mede. The second objection is the Roman army was really the one that just really struck terror into everybody. And thirdly, that Jesus came apparently during the Fourth Kingdom. So I just wonder what you had to, how you could help me with that.
Yeah, well, I've laid it out fairly carefully in The Succession of Nations and Has God Spoken? But if you look at what's going on, you have, first of all, Babylon, obviously under Nebuchadnezzar, being the first of the kingdoms, and the prediction that it would fall from its lofty perch as the golden head of the nations. But as you read on, you'll see that Media, envisioned by Daniel as a beast that looked like a bear, a bear raised up on one of its side with three ribs in its mouth, Ararat, Mini, and Ashkenaz, was instructed, get up and eat your fill of flesh. And what you see ultimately happening in history is Cyrus, who, by the way, was predicted long before he was born by Isaiah, unites both the Median and the Persian empires. And I give the historical intrigue in the book on how that comes to pass and how he became the embodiment of a kingdom of bronze that would rule the whole earth. But to your point, in terms of the imagery itself, prior to unification, Media and Persia are identified separately. The former, as I just mentioned, is identified as a bear. The latter is as a leopard. You see that in Daniel chapter 7. But in the third year of King Belshazzar, the symbolism is altered in order to depict the unified Medo-Persian Empire as a singularity. And therefore, Daniel sees, and you alluded to this again, one ram with two horns standing before the canal, and the horns were long, and one of the horns was longer than the other and grew up later. Now, if you follow the progression in Daniel, you'll see that from the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam, the very birthplace, by the way, of Cyrus the Great, God shows Daniel what is going to happen three centuries later as the Medo-Persian Empire is shattered by the Grecian hordes. And that depiction is quite clear in the book of Daniel. You have a goat with a prominent horn between his eyes, comes from the west, crosses the earth without touching the ground. And the two-horned ram that Daniel saw, according to Gabriel himself, represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat, however, is the kingdom of Greece. And the large horn between his eyes is the first king. And that king, of course, was none other than Alexander the Great. So Gabriel himself gives us the definition. In other words, he doesn't leave the symbolism to our own interpretation. He tells us exactly what is going to go on. And then scarcely a decade after entering Jerusalem, remember that Alexander was dead, killed in his youth, in the prime of his strength. just a month or so short of his 33rd birthday. And again, in keeping with the prophecy of Daniel, at the height of his power, his large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of the earth. So in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, an empire is broken up and parceled out to the four winds of heaven. And, you know, you had the four generals that everybody is familiar with, and the four fractured domains morphing into two dominant empires, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And then what happens later on is you have the Seleucid Empire controlling Israel and becoming the worst of Jewish nightmares, because out of the 10 horns that are described, there's a horn that looks more imposing than the others, has an eye and a mouth, and speaks boastfully. And that horn, with eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully, was envisioned to be a stern-faced king, a master of intrigue. And this was the very stern-faced king that caused Daniel to go limp when he thought about the prophecy and what it portended for the future. Because Daniel is prophesying in the 6th century about something that's going to happen almost 4 centuries or 400 years later, when Antiochus the IV Epiphanes, the Old Testament Antichrist, comes on the scene, and he does the unthinkable, which is the desecration of the most holy place. And if it isn't for the fact that Judas Maccabeus is raised up by God, the temple in Jerusalem would not only been desecrated in the great rush towards Hellenization, but it would be utterly destroyed. And remember, then, Jesus points back to this nightmare emblazoned on the collective memory of every Jew. He points back at this to point forward to another abomination that's going to take place. So the thrust, the climax, as it were, of the kingdoms that Daniel is concerned with is obviously the empire that desecrates the temple, and that's why I see that as the climax. And this comes out of reading Daniel or memorizing Daniel or being familiar with Daniel, as opposed to just familiar with a blueprint that you find on the wall of a Sunday school class. I mean, this is one of the reasons Christians have to read the Bible for all it's worth. I talked to all kinds of pastors, and when they're confronted with this information, they say, well, the only reason I taught the other is because that's what I was taught. Have you ever looked into it? No, not really. Never had the time. And I think this is something that I have to echo as well. There are certain things that people ask me about, and I say, you know what? I keep wanting to get to that issue and give it my solid attention, but I never quite got to it yet. Something else stood in the way. So I can certainly understand this. It happens to me. It happens to everybody. We're all limited in time. But I can assure you that I gave this a great deal of time and effort, as I do with anything that I write. I don't shoot from the hip.
Okay. I'm with you on, that was chapter 8, or the ram and the goat. I'm with you with that, and I understand about Antiochus and all that. So you're saying that are you trying to relate that back to chapter 7 and chapter 2 and use that kind of as a argument for why you do chapter 7 and chapter 2 the way you do?
Well, no. I mean, it's not primarily that. I mean, in some sense, it certainly involves that and heavily involves that, but it's not related exclusively to that. It's taking the whole of Daniel and reading it as a composite piece. The language that is used in various parts of the composite piece are a dead giveaway. You can't miss it if you're really reading it closely. But here's what it takes. It takes sitting down and actually spending some time with it. Not just reading a chapter here and a chapter there, but reading through it systematically, and then reading it again and reading it again, and the pieces do fall into place. And I think I've given you the outline here, so you have sort of a blueprint from which to work and then evaluate, well, is this true or is it not true? If you read the other section in the book under the Abomination of Desolation, there's more clues and more hints that help finish the picture for you, as it were.
Okay, I'm trying to spend a lot of time with it, and I guess I still, when they say, well, how do you interpret the bear raised up on one side if that's not Media and Persia? And I'm just, you know, I'm not sure how to directly answer that question, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I did answer that question earlier, and let me do it again. So, first of all, you have the Median Empire described as a bear. You have the Persian Empire described as a leopard in Daniel chapter 7. But in the third year of King Belshazzar, and you read about this in Daniel chapter 8, I believe, the symbolism is altered in order to depict a unified Medo-Persian Empire as a singularity. And so, what does Daniel do? He sees now a ram with two horns standing before the canal, and the horns are long, one of them longer than the other, but grew up later. The horn that grows up later and longer is the one that depicts the Persian Empire. But he collapses the symbolism into the symbolism of a ram. So he starts out with a bear and a leopard, and then collapses it into the symbolism of a ram. Again, a lot of detail, not only in the chapter titled Succession of Nations, but also later on in the Abomination of Desolation chapter, talking about my book, Has God Spoken?, available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. You can get your copy online at equip.org. Do remember, this is a ministry that can only survive based on the generosity of God's people. If you can support the ministry, right now would be a good time to do it. We were woefully behind in the month of February, hopefully catching up this month. You're part of the solution. Equip.org, you can give there in a safe, secure fashion. Look forward to seeing you right back here tomorrow with more of the show.
You've been listening to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. To learn more about Hank or the Christian Research Institute, just go to equip.org. Equip.org is a fountain of information and resources designed to help you defend the faith and grow in your knowledge of the truth. You can also stream the broadcast live or download archived broadcast. To talk with a resource consultant by phone, call 888-7000-CRI, or you can write to us at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by the Christian Research Institute, a ministry supported solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. Here's what's in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal. Sandy Hook School, the Washington Navy Yard, the Aurora Theater. Mass murders such as these have been shaking the national composure with alarming regularity. And such shootings only begin to tell the story of gun-related violence in America. Should current gun laws be strengthened, or does the solution lie elsewhere? Other topics include The New Nothingness, a look at Lawrence Krauss's A Universe from Nothing. God is love, but is love God? Does the Bible require Christians to attend church? God and the Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics, and much more. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today by calling 888-7000-CRI or subscribe online at equip.org. The battle for authentic Christianity has never been more intense. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a new book called The Ostenification of American Christianity. As the title suggests, Ostenification is nothing short of the wholesale transformation of American, indeed global, Christianity. It is the prime provocateur of a seductive brand of Christianity that reduces God to a means to our ends and beckons multitudes to the table of the Master. Not for the love of the Master, but for what is on the table. You need to defend yourself and those you love against these insidious teachings. Please call today to request The Ostenification of American Christianity.
It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.